Welcome back to the program. Why is it that while we sit at the apogee of 400 years of human progress, and that we have never been closer to democratizing that progress to every corner of the globe, yet we sit today fearful, paralyzed, seeing our futures almost choked off by that fear? As Yeats said, the best lack all conviction, while the worst are full of passion and intensity. While we're busy rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic, the rest of the world looks out at opportunity and progress that it welcomes. We're going to talk about that progress today and the entrepreneurs that are making it possible with my guest, Philip Auserwald. Philip's an associate professor of public policy at George Mason University, a senior fellow at the Kauffman Foundation, an advisor to the Clinton Global Initiative, and the author of a new book entitled The Coming Prosperity, How Entrepreneurs Are Transforming the Global Economy. Philip Auserwald, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me on the program.
Great to have you here. One of the things you talk about is that progress and creative destruction, all the things that entrepreneurs are doing to create progress, are kind of like an invasive species. They can't be stopped.
Well, I mean, that's exactly right. You know, I talk in the book about positive insurgencies of entrepreneurs and entrepreneurship. And this isn't a new phenomenon. This goes back to the absolute origins of democratic capitalism in the late Middle Ages. And it's been this absolute sort of unstoppable determination of people to create and build, even when their progress is obstructed, that has incrementally led to the institutions and to the opportunities that we see all around us today.
And why are we seeing, or seemingly seeing, more resistance to this progress in some ways today?
Well, actually, I think the way you framed it leading in was fantastic. You could have blurred for the book. I think right now in the United States, and so let's focus on that for the moment, we're seeing it for two reasons. One is that in every age of significant disruption, it's natural for people to feel apprehension, even fear. And so to some extent, as we've seen, for example, the fallout from the implosion of the housing market bubble, although it's not widely recognized or discussed to be part of a phenomenon of increased global prosperity, it absolutely was. I mean, the lending that came into the United States to drive that came from increased savings elsewhere in the world in places that were becoming increasingly prosperous. So these phenomena, this interconnection of the global economy, creates all sorts of disruptions and some real discomfort. So we'll start there with the fact that there are some significant changes that people are having to adjust to. But the other aspect is that, of course, those interests that are threatened, the incumbent interests, particularly in this country when we think about our energy infrastructure, we think about our healthcare infrastructure, our financial infrastructure, and our educational infrastructure, where I teach in the university. All of these are significant parts of our economy with organized interests that don't like to see change. And so in every instance, they have a very strong interest in advancing narratives of fear. And what I try to say about this book is I'm not selling optimism, I'm shorting fear. Because the prospects of the fear narratives are very poor, but they're out there everywhere we turn in the public discuss, the public debate.
And as a result of that fear, it causes us, or at least in the public debate, causes us to, in our language, to want to look at everything in a very binary way. There's consumers and creators. There's government, and then there's get government out. There's incumbents and there's startups. There is never the kind of sense of unity among all of this.
Well, I mean, that's absolutely right. And you know, in the book, I talk about the obsolescence of the sort of marketing categories that were created in the 20th century and that have a kind of historical basis, you know, left, right, liberal, conservative. I mean, this language and this way of categorizing options for the future is completely bankrupt and completely obsolete. And I think there's a general understanding in the public that that's the case. The question is, why is that obsolete? I mean, what we're looking at is a world in which these divisions between sort of labor and management, you know, and the encroachment of capital are really completely at odds with a new world in which sort of collaboration, the breakdown of barriers between what we have traditionally thought about as labor and the oversight of labor. I mean, all of these sorts of divisions are really no longer relevant to the opportunities and also to the realities of work in the 21st century. So I think that's part of what's going on, is this sort of breakdown of the divisions that we're used to thinking of the world as being organized in.
Is part of that due to the fact that we have not come up with a clear alternative narrative? I mean, there's the collectivist narrative on the one side, the Howard Roark narrative on the other side. What we haven't found is the narrative that really defines the world we live in today.
Well, you know, the narrative is out there. I mean, Joseph Schumpeter put it out there. He was writing about it quite eloquently in 1928 in a piece called The Instability of Capitalism. And the narrative is one of incumbent interests that are comfortable with the power that they have, that will work to influence, direct, if not outright dictate, the political process. And I'm not just talking about the United States, I'm talking about globally. And those who seek to bring in the new, those who challenge incumbent interests. And so there's this sort of an alignment. And, you know, first of all, I have to keep in mind that this desire of incumbents to protect their position is totally natural. It's to be expected. And yesterday's insurgents are today's incumbents. Look at Amazon and the book market. Right? So this is a process that's being foreshortened, you know, by used to be decades to gain incumbent advantage and then to seek to consolidate that and to prevent entry from others. Now it happens in the space of decades, even less. Or I should say, you know, in a decade or 5 or 10 years. So this is the fundamental organizing principle of political and economic power in a democratic capitalist society. And it doesn't have to do with left or right, and it doesn't have to do with liberal or conservative. It has to do with incumbent advantage and economic insurgence.
And change overall. The idea that, or the notion that the best ideas from a previous generation can often become the worst ideas for future generations, yet those ideas get set in concrete.
Absolutely. No, that's exactly right. I mean, you know, this is Paul Polak's phrase. Paul is himself a remarkable entrepreneur who built an organization that provided created supply chains for treadle pumps in South Asia. And these are small-scale irrigation pumps that provided increased livelihood for more than 2 million people. So he's a person who has really done amazing work in increasing opportunity for people around the world. But Paul has this phrase that I quote in the book, that basically says yesterday that institutions are radical ideas set in concrete, and there are so many illustrations of that where what was the visionary thought of a generation ago then becomes the obstacle that we're trying to overcome today.
Of course, it's the role of entrepreneurs really in creating this change, in creating this creative destruction.
And, you know, I'm so glad that you're turning the conversation on towards these issues, because, you know, there certainly is a core theme of the book is that ours is an era of tremendous promise, and that the transformation of the globe into one where the majority of the world's population is able to participate in 4 centuries of technological and organizational innovation, you know, that this world is one that we should welcome. So you know, and kind of understandably, that's been where a lot of the questions I've had about the book have focused. But where you're focusing on is this issue of the role of entrepreneurs in maintaining the vitality of society. And for people in the United States, that's the critical issue. And the point isn't to demonize insurgent to demonize incumbent advantage or those who advocate for incumbents. They have their role. But for us in the general public who don't work, and I'm not going to name names, we all know the institutions mm-hmm. that are trying to protect themselves. For those of us that aren't in one of those institutions, we should be doing one thing and one thing only, which is favoring incumbents less and trying to advocate for entrepreneurs who do not have the infrastructure to influence that incumbents do. And that's why I write the book focusing on entrepreneurs. It's not to say that incumbents don't provide tremendous services to people and that aren't a valuable part of our economy. But when we think about the future, we should be favoring incumbents less and looking for ways to support entrepreneurs.
Looking for ways to support entrepreneurs and also looking for the areas of growth. I mean, when you talk about the rest of the world, I mean, that becomes appealing because those are the areas of growth. But there are equally appealing areas of growth right here that we often ignore.
You know, that is so true. And I think that when we look around at systems that are frustratingly broken, and certainly when we think about the financial system, it wasn't just what happened in 2008 and the fallout. It's the whole way in which our financial system is organized at present. And I have an S corporation and an LLC that I'm president of, small scale activities, but you know, like other entrepreneurs, I'm trying to grow my ventures. When I try to refinance my lines of credit, or when I get letters that are completely unprovoked from interest rate increase, you know, what I see is this is opportunity. We have got to find ways to disrupt the financial system that we have today and the set of consumer offerings that we have today. So wherever we see frustration with the services that we're receiving from the institutions that dominate, that should be a signal for opportunity. And we have to, all of us, be looking for those opportunities to build and create better for ourselves in this country, not to mention to connect with the opportunities elsewhere in the world.
The other aspect you talk about is the way in which entrepreneurs are grounded in both being adaptable but also dealing with some kind of structure, and that balance is part of what entrepreneurs do.
You know, when I was talking about the obsolescence of the 20th century narrative, I mean, really, it comes down to, when you think about the old style sort of, you know, state capitalism versus the free market sort of worldviews, right? And at their root, on one level, on one end, it's the absolute valuation of structure and order and planning. In a sense that if society could be run like a machine, everything would come out perfectly, right? And so that was sort of the communist planning dream. And on the other side, it's this absolute sort of admiration of or elevation of the states of total disorder. And so when people talk about Hayek and notion of self-organization in the economy, that at some level structures will emerge and miraculously disappear after they've emerged. I mean, that's the other part of the kind of free market fantasy, is that after we've had this wonderful self-organization in society, you don't have incumbent interests that prevent change from happening in the next generation. And that's why I'm such a fan of Joseph Schumpeter, because Joseph Schumpeter really understood the disruptive power of entrepreneurs, but he was enough of a student of reality to see that when entrepreneurs become successful, they like to set up camp and keep new entrepreneurs from coming in. And so it's this interaction. Now, neither of those stories make sense. Neither of those stories is the correct answer. I mean, obviously, the planning fantasy of communism turned out to be one of the worst debacles that are to lead to some of the worst debacles and outright atrocities that humanity has ever seen. But this notion that the free market sort of organizes itself and prevents interest from coming in, that obstruct the functioning of the so-called free market itself, is also a fantasy. So it's this balance between order and adaptability that makes societies work. And we can't just wipe all of our incumbent firms out of the economy. That would be disastrous. But we need this continued vitality that comes from entrepreneurial entry.
But, of course, part of what we're seeing now is this attitude that all government needs to do is get out of the way.
Yeah, well, right. You know, and I'm at the Kauffman Foundation this year, which has been a great experience. You know, the Kauffman Foundation is the foundation of entrepreneurship. And I remember I was in Silicon Valley just a couple of months ago, and I was waiting for a friend in a restaurant, and sitting at a table just by the bar while I was doing that with a couple of sort of older generation entrepreneurs. Anyway, so I told them I was with the Foundation of Entrepreneurship. We struck up a conversation, and they both started to laugh, you know, because the kind of Well, it seems like a paradox. Why do we need a foundation for entrepreneurship, you know? And so it's like, hey, Bill, he's going to teach us about entrepreneurship type thing, right? And I understand that. You know, in some sense, what do we need a foundation of entrepreneurship? Then next thing you know, we're going to have a government agency of entrepreneurship, right? And so that viewpoint is essentially that whatever government does can only obstruct entrepreneurial energy. And I'm somewhat sympathetic with that view. I do not think that entrepreneurship is something that can be engineered, planned, forced, designed. That's just completely antithetical to the nature of entrepreneurship. But on the other hand, it is just incorrect to think that entrepreneurs operate in a vacuum, absence of any other societal structures, and that when we think about education, when we think about research, and when we think about the fundamental design of our market, which does come from government regulations and rules, not all of which are misplaced or abusive, you know, that all of that is part of thinking about what environment entrepreneurs operate in. So government out of the way is not the right way to think about how government interacts with entrepreneurs to create opportunity.
Is part of the problem in terms of the way we see government that it is one of the few areas where we see virtually no creative destruction?
Well, you know, that's a really great point, because, and the same is true in the, you know, so-called not-for-profit sector.
Correct.
I mean, when we look at organizations like the Red Cross, you know, wonderful organization, right? But it's been around a very, very long time. And post-Katrina, you know, when we saw all the donations that were coming into the Red Cross, and there were a lot of questions asked, including by me, you know, by people who sort of think about recovery and societal resilience. And, you know, is the Red Cross the organization that's best positioned to turn New Orleans around in the longer term? This isn't just a question of recovering from immediate disaster. This is a question from really rebuilding a city that's a national treasure. And so, but we don't see entry in not-for-profit, and we don't see entry in disruption in government. And the whole notion that a government agency once set up is really difficult to take down, you know, has a lot of historical credence to it. So that's what we need to work on. We got to repurpose pretty much every aspect of our public infrastructure, just like we have to repurpose a lot of our private infrastructure. A lot of our private companies have to think about the role that they have. But the market can be a much more brutal disciplining force than what we see in the political process.
The danger is, coming back to kind of where we started, in snuffing all of this out, is the fear which makes it so difficult.
This is the challenge facing the United States in the next 10 years. You know, my George Mason colleague, Tyler Cowen, wrote a bestseller last spring, which on the surface of it seems completely opposed to the book that I've written, The Coming Prosperity. Tyler Cowen's book was called The Great Stagnation. And then another good friend who also was formerly at George Mason, Richard Florida, now at the University of Toronto, wrote a book just after the crash called The Great Reset. And, you know, this is, to me, these are the stories that are really laying out where we are. And, you know, of course, they're not the only ones. They just happen to be friends and folks whose work that I follow. But, you know, they're getting exactly the point that you're making. Are we going to be so afraid of change that we do exactly those things that will cut us off from opportunity in the next quarter century? And it's possible that that will happen. In which case, we will be watching from the sidelines while the greatest moment of opportunity creation and the realization of human aspiration in human history happens before our eyes, and we will be spectators because we were too afraid to participate.
You make that point even with respect to immigration and immigrants here in America.
I mean, not even with respect to. I mean, to me, that's right at the heart of it. That is right at the heart of it. Because, you know, we're talking about, you know, whether we should have more H-1B visas, you know, whether we should raise the cap on the number of extremely talented people that we allow into the country to help grow and develop our economy. That's where the debate is now. Where the debate needs to be is an appreciation in every town, in every university, in every state in the country, that our newest Americans, the most recently arrived Americans, are our collaborative advantage. These are the people who have deep connections in other parts of the world where global growth will be happening in the next 25 to 50 years. I don't know how to sell a water filtration device in Ghana. I just can't do that on my own. I need a partner. But if I happen to work in a coffee shop here in D.C. with a young entrepreneur who is Ghanaian and whose family is tied into a distribution infrastructure, a production infrastructure, whatever is required to realize my own entrepreneurial aspirations, I'm going to be way down the road towards achieving that objective. So every one of us, as a matter of our own self-interest, should be cultivating relationships with those people who have contacts where global growth will be happening in the next 25 years. This is vitally important. And we can do this on an institutional level as well. So I talk about this as it's relational capital that is the core of the collaborative advantage of the United States right now and into the next quarter century.
It also provides opportunity in terms of growth markets here, because that's where to look. It's the newcomers that we're going to look to for the new markets here.
Well, that's, you know, I mean, and it gets back to what you were saying earlier. Just because global growth is going to be overwhelmingly coming from previously poor places, that's what we've seen in the last 20 years, that's what's going to continue. There's absolutely no reason for that trend to stop. Doesn't mean that we, in a country of 300 million people, have to exclusively look overseas or to very faraway places for entrepreneurial opportunities. So there's a whole lot that we can do in transforming this country, and you know, this sort of new idea flow and all of the relational networks that can bring new ideas into the United States and products are also of great value. So, yeah, absolutely. It's both ways.
One of the other things you talk about goes to the very heart of how we talk about these things, the idea that we're using 19th and 20th century language to try and deal with these 21st century issues.
Well, and, you know, we're barely 10 years into the 21st century, so we've got to give ourselves a little bit of a break. You know, Schumpeter, who I was referring to earlier, wrote his greatest work, The Theory of Economic Development, in 1911, and he was looking at changes that had happened 30 or 40 years before that. So I think it does take a little while to catch up. But it's time that we did. It's time that we did. And honestly, you know, as soon as I see any columnist or TV pundit or whoever it happens to be start talking about the left thinks this and the right thinks this, and believe me, I was born in Washington, D.C., okay? I mean, I live in Washington, D.C. My father spent his career in the federal government. I mean, you know, I've had more of this political talk in my life probably than most Americans have, right? But for pretty much that reason, I listen to radio and I read the newspapers, and obviously I look at things online. I don't watch TV anymore. I just completely shut it down because as far as learning about the things that matter to me, I don't get any information.
Talk a little bit about special interests and these incumbent interests today using in some ways newer technology and a lot more money to further enhance and protect their positions.
You know, this is the race whenever there's change. And people talk about it in terms of the democratizing impact of social media. And, you know, whether it's in the United States or overseas, and, it, you know, there's the sort of argument that governments will be able to, and, you know, not to mention private business interests, which are the focus of your question, you know, be able to use these new technologies at least as effectively as these positive insurgents that I'm talking about, just to kind of maintain and maintain their power. And that's to be expected. And we have to really understand that the deep pockets and the people who are paid by the deep pockets, who ultimately have filled their pockets with money that we give them on a regular basis, in one mechanism or another, they're going to be making the most of the new tools, just as everybody else will. And, you know, it's just a question of this is the kind of a paradox, a seeming paradox of the title of my book and the whole theme of the book, is on one hand, I'm sort of claiming that there are these global trends that are so positive that almost nothing can stop them, and there's this kind of seeming sense of inevitability in you know, the title, The Coming Prosperity. And on the other hand, what I'm trying to say today, and clearly, you know, point of the book, is that nothing good happens unless people make it happen. And I'm focusing on people I'm calling entrepreneurs. But obviously there's a lot of people who create the new in society that wouldn't necessarily call themselves entrepreneurs, or that aren't creating new firms in some sort of a narrow sense. Those are the people that are using all the new possibilities that come about through technological innovation and institutional development to create new spaces to push back against incumbent interest and to keep society moving. And it's going to be a battle. That's just the way it is. It's just the way it is. And all of us who want to create the new, who want to create spaces for the new, and who don't want to just live in the 20th century for the next 100 years, we're going to have to work, because everybody else is going to be out there, working as well to protect what they have.
Philip Auerswald, the book is The Coming Prosperity, How Entrepreneurs Are Transforming the Global Economy. It's just out from Oxford University Press. Philip, I thank you so much for spending time with us.
Thank you for your great questions. Really enjoyed being on the program.
Thank you.